Hello, and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Renikus.
I am Paul Jacobs.
And we're at home, of course, still. And in this episode, we're talking finance. And specifically, we're talking to Andrew Rummer from Finamize, who describe themselves as an insight platform for personal wealth management.
Yeah, and we've got Chris Smith, managing partner at Playfair Capital, who are a leading pre-seed and seed stage venture capital fund. And first, I'd like to welcome onto the pod, Chris from Playfair Capital. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a conversation I've been looking forward to having for sure. With a lot of our clients, kind of funding and kind of investment is a conversation we're always talking about with them. So it only made sense that we bring that into the podcast and get your expert view. So for kind of those who are not aware of Playfair Capital, would you do the kindness and just introduce kind of who you are and why you're different?
Yeah, of course. So first, thanks so much for having me on. Just give a little bit of background on Playfair. So we are a seed stage or even pre-seed stage VC fund based in London. We've been going since 2013 and we're on our second fund, which we closed in March last year. So essentially what we do, we invest anything between about £100,000 up to £500,000 into tech companies. And we're a generalist fund. So we don't have any real particular sector focus. But in Fund 2, we really like deep tech companies and we like companies that have a B2B distribution model. But we're pretty open-minded. And I think that kind of comes from the fact that before joining Playfair, I did a bunch of things. One of them was being an angel investor. Our founder, in fact, Federico, he was an angel investor. And with that mentality, you tend to really look at things that excite you. And you don't always know what they are until you meet them. We look for the things that other VCs look for. We'll probably get onto that later. But I think we add an extra layer, and that is that we only invest in companies we're passionate about. So really anything you see in our portfolio, we as the team have got really excited about that business. We may have been excited about the concept earlier on, or the founder may have sort of brought us along on their journey. But I think what that means is that every day we get out of bed, we're thinking about ways to help those companies. And again, we'll talk about it later, but you know, we do that in a variety of different ways.
For you then, Chris, kind of you sort of touched a few bits about your journey and angel investment, but as a trained lawyer, what took you into investment from kind of that education and I guess that skill set? How does that play out for you in terms of being working for Playfair?
I suppose in some ways, you know, kind of quite a traditional background. You know, school careers advisor suggested a profession. Ruled out being a doctor because I hate blood, ruled out accounting because I don't love numbers. I like them, but I really love words and I love writing. And so they're, oh, Chris, you should be a lawyer. And that kind of sets you on this path, which is, when you're young, it's quite compelling actually, because you go to university, law school is then the next natural step. It gets paid for. You then start a training contract. Your salary increases each year and you think, yeah, this is okay. I think I realized pretty early on into being a lawyer that this is not what I was passionate about. It took me a lot longer to realize that that's not okay and that actually I should be focusing on kind of what makes me happy and doing what I'm interested in. So it ended up being quite a long journey. There's probably two more bits to add on. One is the angel investing, which I touched on earlier. So I started that, I think, after spending 6 months in Silicon Valley as a lawyer. I got to learn about what does VC mean? What angel investors do? I started reading about George Dorio, the founder, the grandfather of VC, and it just really interested me. And I kind of held that until I got back to London when I made my first angel investment. And I also set up a telecoms business at university. So I think I didn't join all of these dots, but now looking back, kind of makes sense that I love building things. I like investing in things and being part of the journey. I understand how to do transactions and I've got a pretty good insight into how to grow a business, at least that initial kind of first 100 employees. And so, yeah, seed stage venture was the natural place to go. I had many times where I was, really quite, miserable being a lawyer and I had no idea how I was going to get out. I think the financial crisis was really challenging. And I think, obviously, we'll talk about COVID. We can't not. But I think the financial crisis, for me, it was difficult because I qualified in 2007 as a lawyer. And the usual path for someone who's like, I'm going to qualify as a lawyer and then see what's out there, what's more exciting that I can do. You basically stayed in a law firm for 2 or 3 years and you left. And that exit, it was shut, because once the financial crisis hit, you had people who were much more qualified than me, had ex-investment bankers, consultants, accountants, you know, tens of thousands of those people out in the market looking to move into hedge funds, private equity, VC. So that route was completely shut. So that was quite a challenging time. And I think it was just a case of just patience and just grit and just try and get through it.
You sound like an entrepreneur. And I'm sure that's part of the fascination when you're working with other businesses. I'm really lucky and humbled that I've got a handful of pals who have done startups. And one of the things we talk about a lot is angel or VC. Does it have to be one or the other? And if it doesn't, what makes a great angel and what makes a great VC partner?
It's a really good question. By the way, I do think, I mean, there's something in me that's entrepreneurial. I think what I figured out was that I loved starting my telecoms business and I loved the first 2 or 3 years at Plan.com. After that, I started to get a little bit stagnant and I felt that I wasn't having as much impact. So the reason I think VC makes sense is because you can kind of do it time and time again with lots of different companies. But I mean, on the angel versus VC piece, I think the ideal route is angel then VC. I think that you get a great angel investor who comes in, is passionate about what you do, who understands what VCs are looking for, and is able to professionalize what you're doing, is able to make introductions, is able to sort of get you to the next level. And then the VC comes in and wraps around you the network and the support and the expertise to get to the next level. So in really simple terms, I kind of see this industry is, it's almost like passing a ball. You know, you start your company, the angel investor has it, they do what they do to get it to the next level. You do your pre-seed or seed round. That fund should have the expertise you need at that point in time. So to grow from maybe the co-founders to a team of 20, to do your first, you know, help on your first product launch, whatever it is, you then hand the ball to the Series A fund and they're much better at the, I don't know, the international expansion piece or whatever it is. So there is a very natural, nice trajectory you can go on. One thing I would say, though, is there is absolutely nothing wrong with just taking angel investment and growing a really good-sized business and then achieving an exit. Because, you know, the more money you take on, the more dilution you have means you need a bigger outcome. And so not everyone wants to or should get on that treadmill.
And again, my pals speak an awful lot about, and I'm going to use their words, vibe. When they're looking for an angel, it's like, yeah, that was the right vibe. And it sounds incredibly unscientific. How would you advise a startup to pick an angel?
I like it. Vibe. It's good. I think that it's relationship driven. You know, I saw what was actually quite a depressing tweet the other day, which is that the average life of a US marriage is about 8 years. And I think the average hold period for a VC investment is longer. So they were making the point that you've clearly got to choose your partner, your investment partner, very carefully. I think relationship is everything. And, you know, angels and VCs at the stage where Playfair's at, we do invest in the founders. We're investing in their character, the relationship we can build with them, all these kind of qualitative things that are quite hard to sum up. When it goes further up the capital structure, people start investing on metrics and numbers, and it's a little bit different. But that's sound advice. Invest on vibe, invest on the relationship.
The other story I hear a lot is the pitch. And I'm thinking of one of my pals who was out in LA, and that in itself was a completely bizarre experience pitching. But the pitch does still sound like a very intimidating, very macho Dragon's Den. Does it have to be like that nowadays in 2020?
No, and it shouldn't be. I think there's a difference of approach between funds at different stages, between individual approaches at different funds, and I think probably a difference between, you know, the US and Europe. You know, we approach a pitch. For us, the best pitch is a dialogue. It's a two-way conversation. There's, you know, questions being asked, answers. And one of the things that interests me is that when we have founders, in the good old days when founders used to come to our office and we used to sit down and we used to ask them things like, oh, you know, where's your office? And you know, how's your day going? And yeah, tell us your story. What did you do? They're a bit surprised. They've already flipped open their laptop and they're kind of ready to do their presentation. And we're like, no, we're really interested in you as a person because that's what we're backing. So I think I think entrepreneurs should read quite a lot, actually, from how the VC treats them in that pitch meeting. I don't think it's right that you make it, as you say, such a macho kind of one-sided experience.
So, Chris, I, for one, want to know a bit more about who you guys are investing in. Tell us a little bit more about kind of the type of brands that you're going for and what is it you're looking for when you come to invest?
What do we look for? Yeah, we look for amazing founders. We kind of talked about it. It's kind of hard to really put that down on paper. You just know. And I think what's really interesting during COVID has been we've known that over video. So founders who are good in person have also been great over video as well. So you're looking for founders. It's about their character. It's about their persistence. It's about a track record of success. Not necessarily traditional academic. It can be lots of different things. We're talking to a company now where one of the co-founders was a racing driver before turning to be an entrepreneur. But we just look for that kind of that X factor. We look for big markets. So you need to have a big market. It needs to be a market that's growing because it needs to support a really big company. And, you know, we look, like most VCs look for, however you say it, it sounds a bit crude, but we basically look for billion-dollar opportunities. We look for 100x returns. You know, we're looking for really big returns because that's the way VC works. We're going to have failures in our portfolio. We will get the bulk of our returns from the two or three that do really well. I think product probably comes next. You know, we're looking for products that are not incremental improvements. We're looking for products that really, really change the way businesses do things. And I guess alongside that is it needs to be solving a real pain point and it needs to have clear ROI for the customer. So we talk about the difference between painkillers and vitamins, which I didn't come up with. I had no idea who did, but it was a great, great expression. So, you know, the idea of a painkiller, actually, you need it. You have to have it. And therefore, you're more likely to pay money for it, particularly relevant in poor macroeconomic times, in a recession. Vitamin, on the other hand, it's really nice to have. So for me, I'd put a lot of sort of consumer-facing apps in that category, you know, much tougher business. So we generally prefer to invest in painkillers as well. And I think the final bit for us is, you know, we like deep tech. So deep tech's kind of overused. It typically includes things like AI, like machine learning, like computer vision. But it's basically tech that is hard to replicate because nowadays it's quite easy to build software. So if you've got something that can be readily copied, someone can come and out execute you, someone can be better funded than you. We look for some kind of defensibility in the technology as well. For me, the best founders impress us more and more as you go through a process. So the best founders will almost constantly surprise you with their responsiveness. So they'll be incredibly quick and they'll get back to you with very detailed answers. They'll anticipate what you're going to ask next. You'll basically keep digging and they'll keep having answers and you'll get this real comfort that they're a domain expert in what they're doing. So I think if you're not a naturally, you know, extroverted person, if you're not naturally brilliant at presenting, knowing your business inside out is going to, you know, is a good sort of substitute for that.
One of your main events, actually, which I'm a huge fan of, Chris, is around focusing on female founders. So I know it's one of a few events that you do, but I feel it's incredibly relevant. So let's dive into a bit around kind of diversity and inclusion, and you guys should have a good perspective. How important kind of is that female founder initiative that you've got in your search for new investments?
I think the biggest problem potentially in the VC industry is this reliance on warm introductions and networks. It's kind of understandable because it makes your life as a VC easier if you only sort of respond to things that come through people you know. But it just means you're missing out on so many opportunities you wouldn't see otherwise. And so this Female Founders event gets rid of that need. It's great for us. It's helping us certainly see a lot more deals that we probably wouldn't otherwise.
For Playfair, will this go beyond kind of gender and into kind of supporting the ethnic minorities and growing the founder base there?
Yeah, so we've made a decision, at least at the moment, that what we're going to do is essentially sort of crowdsource our playbook for this event to other funds that want to do something similar, you know, whether it's the BAME community, whether it's other underrepresented founders. And I think so far, we've certainly supported two other female founder events, one in the US, one in Southeast Asia. And there's another event, I think it's a BAME-focused event at Wara that's happening we're supporting as well. So we think the best way is to kind of share our kind of best practice in this area to sort of broaden out the impact. Worth saying, and it's a slight plug, but we're hiring a community manager at the moment. His job is going to be to continue to build on a lot of these initiatives. So I guess in the future, watch this space.
The most exciting bit for me, reverting to type, is when the startup actually is out there. So, you know, I'm a marketer, so it's the go-to market strategy. How important is that for you when you're looking at the investment in weighing up the feasibility of this particular product or service?
Yeah, it's massive. So I think there's lots of ways that founders can fall down when they pitch to us or when they approach us. But I think one of the biggest ways is that they're just presenting us with a deck and they've not actually done anything. So for me, people who are prepared to go out there to start hustling essentially without much money, you know, bootstrapping it themselves is absolutely key. And I think that is very key around customer acquisition, around marketing. You know, how do you know people want your product or service and how are you going to reach them? And I think often that's one of the biggest questions that we need to answer as investors. Frequently we see companies, and this is particularly the case with B2C, so consumer-facing companies, where a conclusion that I see is often, yes, we can see them getting a few hundred or a few thousand customers. We just can't see this getting to 1 million, 2 million, 3 million. We can't see it breaking through to be as big as we need it to be to make an investment. And I think those founders that are able to answer how they do that with a sensible marketing strategy that takes account of how it will change over time is really compelling. We don't see it very often, though.
So I think the go-to-market strategy is probably where our worlds best collide, Chris, I'd say, in terms of kind of, let's get the investment guy's perspective on, I guess, the importance of marketing within that go-to-market strategy.
Yeah, hugely important, often overlooked, I think, by founders, actually. So it may be, I guess, a reflection of the types of founders that we work with. So they tend to be more technical because they've got, you know, deep technology as a part of their business. But actually, and I'm going to lump sales in here. You'll tell me why I'm wrong and it's different. But we include kind of sales and marketing, the go-to-market strategy altogether. I think frequently founders have not really thought it through. And what they tend to do is extrapolate some early positive conversations with a handful of companies into, well, I can therefore go and take 10, 15% or whatever of the available market. And equally, they tend to make a mistake of assuming that one acquisition channel, which works now, is going to continue to work going forward. And that's particularly the case with something like paid search, where they can show, look, it's really cheap at the moment. And we try and explain, yeah, but you know, you're reaching early adopters and it's early, and but it might get more competitive. And so what's your backup plan if that doesn't work? So to me, the most impressive founders have a broad view. They have multiple ways of acquiring customers, which again, changes over time. We don't see it that often. It's often something we have to help founders with, but even telling us that they know it's going to have to be, you know, lots of different channels, lots of different routes over time. You know, the founders that tell me, well, I think channel partnerships could be interesting, music to my ears, because, you know, some founders don't even get to that point.
So, Chris, imagine you have invested in my amazing startup. What kind of relationship should I expect to have with you? How often am I going to see you? How much are you going to be meddling in my business?
That's a great question. So I think there's different types of investments that we do without complicating it too much. There'll be investments that we lead, where we take a board seat and we're therefore formally involved at periodic board meetings every sort of month or 2 months. And there are investments where we're a little bit more passive and we will not have a board seat. So maybe we'll do the first one where we do have a board seat. And in that situation, most people think that the board is the kind of most important forum. For me, that's not the case. The board tends to be an opportunity to take stock. It's a little bit of a reporting place. But actually, the important stuff happens between board meetings where the real business is going on. And I think my interactions with founders tends to be very frequent at their request. So I'm on WhatsApp groups with all the founders where we're invested. They will ping me and ask me questions about anything from, can you just have a quick look at this blog post, to can you recommend a good accountant, to whatever they need, basically, I'm there for, and they can ask me those types of questions. And then we obviously look out opportunistically for things that they can do. So this morning I was contacted by someone looking for a anyone who wants to talk about mental health on a podcast, so I immediately ping that over to the team at Hika. So we kind of look out proactively for opportunities as well. And then I guess the other element is that we have, I guess, particular skill sets in Playfair. So mine would be generally around sales and kind of PR and creating a good equity story. So I'll help if they are hiring salespeople or building out a commission plan or something like that. My partner, Joe, used to be at Google and Facebook doing recruitment. So he helps on hiring. And that is probably, I think, is the most important thing that founders need to get right between sort of seed and series A. So he will actually go in, embed himself in the company and help them develop and build a really robust hiring process. He just spent about 6 weeks with a company called Omnipresent and worked with them to get that ready so they can now go and run it themselves. And we have other skills as well. So then there's sort of project stuff. And then again, if we're a little bit more passive and don't have a board seat, we actually do most of what I just said and still support, you know, as much as we can. It comes back to what I said earlier. We invest in companies we're passionate and excited about. So we naturally just want to help. But to your point about meddling, no. I think it's really important that we recognize sometimes we don't talk to founders for, you know, a month because we know they're in the middle of doing something, a really big project, or they're under pressure. That's absolutely fine. You know, we are here to work for the founders.
One thing I've learned about chatting to founders is they've almost always got somebody in their minds who they have as a mentor or people who they admire. Is there somebody, and it could be anybody, who you would wished you could have had as a mentor?
I'm going to choose two. So one I'm going to get roundly criticized by my colleagues for saying, because it makes me sound very old, but is Bill Gates. And I watched a great Netflix documentary. I think it was called Inside Bill's Brain. Yeah. I just think the way that he sees the world, you know, obviously successes speak for themselves, but I think the way he sees the world, the way he's sort of turned himself to his philanthropic ventures, I think is great. And, you know, he's going to have a really sort of useful career, you know, I guess into his dies, which is what we all kind of aspire to. You know, I don't want to retire and just sit there doing nothing. I think he's kind of found his calling. So I think, yeah, certainly that's one. The other one is a guy called Alan Patrickoff, who is a 82-year-old VC who has just launched a new fund focused on the silver tsunami. So it's basically focused on aging technology. And Alan Patrickoff, I believe he founded Apax. He founded one of the biggest private equity funds and built it into a sort of global titan. He then founded another VC fund, and this is his kind of third go around. And it's just amazing to listen to him. You know, he's 82, and he just said, keeps me young. You know, coming to the office may not be a full day, but I get to listen to younger people talking about, you know, amazing things that they want to do, and it keeps me fresh. So I think that's pretty inspirational.
And one last question for you, Chris, which we ask all of our guests, and I'm particularly looking forward to this one as a non-marketeer that we've got on the show. What's your favorite TV ad and why?
So I think there is a series of Tango adverts, which again is probably going to show my age, but also my immaturity as well, where there is a gentleman who is on a swivel office chair fired into a box of apples to produce a Tesco apple drink. And I also recall a guy who strapped himself to the ceiling of his flat waiting for a train to go by so that he would be released and fall into the apples or origins and also make some Tango drinks. So for me, absolute classics. I still remember them to this day, so they obviously achieved their effect.
That looks good. That looks very good. Yes, that's the hit of the whole fruit right there. Stick one in your mouth. You know when you've been tangoed.
Well, look, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. I've really found it really interesting. As I said at the top, like it's an education piece for me personally. So hopefully our listeners have enjoyed kind of getting a bit more insight around investment and funding. And as I said, we've got a marketing hat on at most of the time, but equally it's so important for us to kind of better understand your world. So thank you very much for joining us and take care.
Thank you.
Our second guest in this episode also works in the world of finance, Andrew Rummer from Finimize, which is a financial news and insight app designed to empower people to make their own informed investment decisions. Welcome, Andrew. Please tell us about Finimize.
So Finimize wants to be the source that you check before you make any financial decision. So we have a phone app. We have a quick daily update of two or three important news stories that have happened overnight in the world of business and finance. In the app, we also have deeper, more analytical articles that we call insights. And then we have this big library of educational explainers on topics like how to build an investment portfolio or how to figure out what your favorite tech stock is really worth, things like that. All of our content is available in both audio and text because we find that different people take in information in different ways. The vast majority of our content is behind a paywall. It's in our app. We have a free trial in the app to let people try it out, and then you have to subscribe. But like, we don't really have any free content in the app as such. Although we do have a free daily newsletter, which just has the highlights that some people get.
Who's using it, Andrew? Because it's quite a broad resource, isn't it? Have you identified a particular sweet spot in terms of the target audience?
The Finimize audience definitely skews young. People are generally in their 20s, early 30s. Not exclusively. We have people of all ages, but it definitely skews young. I think really our users have realized that there's value in having knowledgeable people curate and explain complicated topics to them. So, the world of finance, the world of business is not necessarily the sexiest thing that is top of mind for everyone, particularly young people. So if they have people that they can go to that they trust, they understand that the people who are writing this are genuinely knowledgeable. I mean, our writers generally have done this professionally, like their analysts from Goldman Sachs or Fidelity or other places like that. Done this professionally, and now they're moving into writing. So, they can trust our writers. They really know what they're talking about. And then on top of that, we managed to keep everything, super fun and super engaging. We have lots of silly GIFs and emojis and cultural references that just keep everything light and fun so that it's not like a chore. Frankly, the Finimize philosophy is it's not really truly important to you. We just won't write about it. We won't waste your time. We're very respectful of our users' time. So we have a handful of articles written by experts and highly curated and really telling you why the hell you should even care about this topic after all.
There was a lovely line on the website, which I'm probably going to misquote, but it was something like, young people no longer use travel agents, so why would they use a financial advisor? Well, what is it about this generation then that means they want to be more in control, including financial information to influence their investment decisions?
So, the travel analogy is a good one here. I mean, 25 plus years ago, you would have visited a travel agent if you wanted to book a holiday. You would have gone down to High Street and talked to someone in Thomas Cook. Ultimately, that employee that you would have been talking to in the travel agent would have been looking at a screen of available bookings. They would have been looking at flights, hotels, and people realized that, you could effectively take that screen off them and turn it around and look into that screen yourself. And you could see what the travel agent had been seeing thanks to the internet. So you will find that most verticals now are being saturated with consumer facing apps and being those middle people, the agents are being disintermediated. So, travel, you've got TripAdvisor, Airbnb, places like that. They give you kind of direct mainline into the information yourself. Dining, obviously you've got Just Eat, Deliveroo, these kind of apps, health and fitness, you've got Strava, I guess Headspace, Weight Watcher, which I think is called WW nowadays in this weird rebranding. So Finimize wants to be the consumer facing app that owns that financial vertical, and no one's really done it yet. So that's the opportunity we're going for. Effectively, we want to disintermediate the agents in the finance space in the way that has been done in say, travel.
So how do you see things evolving? Do you see things shifting away from financial advice into the empowerment of the individual?
Look, I think this sector has already come a long way, to be fair to finance and investing. There's a lot of investing apps that we've seen come along the past decade or so that are much more focused on the user experience. We've seen, there's lots of people out there, there's Nutmeg, Moneybox, Wealthify, these kind of apps. I guess you could lump them together as robo-advisors is often the kind of generic term that's given to them. They have really quite good customer experience already. Like it wouldn't be fair to say that this is a sector that's, totally stuck in the dark ages. Those products do exist. And if you go to their websites or download their app, they will, kind of talk you through everything you need to do to set up an account and start paying in a certain amount every month. And that's a great way to go. The thing that they haven't yet broken though, is fear and apathy. You have to actually be quite active to even get to that point. If you think of Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, he famously said that Netflix's main competitor is sleep. As in, it's not about watching Netflix or Amazon, it's like watching Netflix or going to bed. In this particular space, in the finance investing space, I think the main competitors are really apathy and ignorance and fear. It's people that kind of, they've even, first of all, maybe never even considered that this is something that they should think about, is one thing that we want to try and tackle. The other is like, when they've got to that point, they might have done a bit of Googling and come up with, where should I put my savings or something like that. So, some standard Googling, and you just get overwhelmed with crazy amounts of information. It's one of the sectors where, a Google search will not particularly help you. You'll just end up with lots of contradictory articles, some very mixed quality of information.
I certainly suffer from information overload. How do you ensure that that this isn't one more thing that I stress about not checking?
Well, I think any content-based product that is, it's Achilles heel, I suppose. Curation is the heart of Finimize. I mean, it's kind of in the name. It's finance minimized. As I said earlier, we only produce a handful of stories a day. The point is that you should be able to consume absolutely everything that we publish in a day in certainly less than 15 minutes, which sounds a bit odd if you're thinking about traditional publishers like, I guess in our space, you've got Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and so on. Like I said, they're producing hundreds of articles a day. No one, the editors-in-chief of those publications, have the time to read their entire output. We're effectively saying, you don't need to worry about all of that. We will sift through all of that for you, and we'll curate it for you. We'll have, our own stories and in our own way, but ultimately, we kind of sit on top of that mass of financial journalism and say, look, a lot of the reason people are willing to pay for Finimize is that, we provide that filtering for them in an intelligent way.
But I think it's safe to say that kind of a lot of trusted sources around kind of wealth and finance have really boomed during lockdown. How has that been for Finimize? Are you seeing the same?
We definitely had a spike in engagement and content consumption in late February and into March. The world is being turned upside down. Markets were crashing. People were keen to know what the hell was going on. So we definitely saw that. And then kind of weirdly, into April, particularly when, there was a week or so when the UK lockdown first came in, and a fair chunk of our audience are based in the UK. Although it's ultimately very global. But when that UK lockdown came in, it did seem that everyone was just figuring out what the hell they're going to do with this new life. And they got out of a lot of habits that they formed, like maybe they were listening to our morning daily briefing on their commute to work, on the bus or the train. So we did actually weirdly see after that huge spike in engagement, then in April we had a bit of a lull, a couple of weeks, and then it came back again as I guess people fell into new routines and they're like, okay, fine, maybe I'm not going to listen to that briefing on the train, but I'm going to listen to it while I do my workout or, you know, whatever it may be on my bedroom floor. So, you know, that was the kind of broad trend that we saw in terms of engagement with that content. And I guess generally we've just seen a really healthy growth in new subscribers coming through. I mean, I guess like anyone selling something, you do worry going into what's looking like a really deep recession that, you know, people will cancel or be harder to get new people buying your service. We haven't seen that so far, which is great. You know, there is some, you know, decent chunk of Finimize's revenue is still from traditional advertising. We sell advertising slots in our daily newsletter. And that got a little bit scary back in, you know, April and into May. The dry up in marketing budgets, you know, really hurt. I'm sure I'm not the first person on this podcast to talk about those kind of trends. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's thankfully, at least from our point of view, that's, you know, that's come back and we're, you know, actually seeing some really healthy advertising spend at the moment.
I'd love to get to know Andrew a bit more because you've had a really varied journey. Forgive me, I stalked you on LinkedIn. You are a mechanical engineer. You became the managing editor of Bloomberg. That's an amazing journey. So tell us, and you've also got your own side hustle. So yeah. Where do I start? Let's get inside Andrew. Tell me a bit about Andrew.
I don't talk about myself that much, I guess, but yeah. I have had two major career shifts. I don't know if I'd ever describe myself as a mechanical engineer, but I did do an engineering degree. And, you know, partway through that degree, I really enjoyed my degree, but all the kind of forays into work experience that I did were not particularly fulfilling during my, you know, my summers out. I think, you know, I guess talking big picture, the UK, certainly back then when, you know, going to date myself, I graduated in 2003. So that's like proper late stage .com bust. Like engineers were not hugely in demand. The engineering jobs that I saw out there were like working in the oil industry or maybe for an arms manufacturer. Those are the kind of things that Britain does quite well. I think if I'd have graduated 10 years later, I would have been like, oh yeah, I want to join Google or I want to join Facebook. You know, it would have been that kind of career path. But I, you know, that didn't feel, and that wasn't something that people particularly wanted to pursue in the UK back in 2002, 2003. So I kind of graduated. I looked around at things that looked interesting to me and eventually persuaded someone to employ me as a journalist in this pretty small little news agency based in South London. It, you know, wasn't the most glamorous first job. I think if I'd have had this, you know, burning desire, like I will be a journalist, if I'd have known that from the age of 12 and kind of planned things, then, you know, it might have been an easier path in some ways to actually have that goal to work towards. But, you know, I kind of believe in a bit of serendipity and a bit of accident and all of these things. I guess from that small agency, I managed to convince Bloomberg that I was worth employing and then, yeah, had a, you know, got promoted there a few times and really enjoyed my time at Bloomberg. It's a fantastic place to work in a lot of ways. And then I guess my second big career shift was, out of that journalism role into... you know, starting my own small business, as you mentioned, I still run as a side hustle. And then, you know, finding a role at a really exciting high growth startup, which is Finimize. You know, Finimize thing again came along pretty accidentally. I wasn't, you know, they weren't particularly looking to hire someone like me. And I wasn't particularly looking to work there. I was just a reader. I was a user and I, you know, what happened that they contacted me again, I think through LinkedIn and said, oh, you know, we're always trying to understand our users better. If you're ever in Clerkenwell, pop by in the office and say hi. It's a couple of years ago. So I went in, met some people from the community team there who were, you know, really just trying to understand user behavior better, which, you know, Finimize is an incredibly user-focused business, which is pretty odd for journalism. Most journalists just, I don't know, somehow think they're doing God's work, and, you know, journalists never think about what they're producing and why people might want to pay for it. You know, they just think, well, I'm a journalist, I'm amazing, and, you know, this story I wrote is really fantastic, and I'm going to win some prize for it. And they don't, once they've hit publish, they don't necessarily think about what happens after that point. So it's, you know, it's really interesting for me to meet people at Finimize who are like, you know, they just really desperate to understand the users and, you know, how did this thing fit into my day? And, you know, why did I like it and what could they do better? Which, you know, totally a breath of fresh air for me. And then after talking to them for like 4 or 5 minutes and explaining a bit about my background, they basically said, oh, you know, maybe you could like come and work here or something. which was like, what? so that was a pretty random left turn as well. I guess that's, yeah, like I say, my a bit of a random career overall.
Okay. You're one of those people who I love who have an amazing job title, which I'm sure you had a role in choosing, getting to know you. So you describe yourself as entrepreneur in residence. So when your mum said, Andrew, what does that mean? What did you say?
Yeah, it is a rather silly job title. I didn't come up with it. My boss, Max, founder of Finimize, came up with that job title. You know, what it really means day to day is that I'm responsible for pushing the new projects forward. You know, always thinking about what's the new thing, what should we be doing next, what do users want, particularly where those projects are at the intersection of content, which is obviously, you know, where I spent most of my career, and product. Because, you know, I guess I have a mind that, you know, thinks about product, thinks about business models, and is happy to marry all of those things together. As I was kind of alluding to earlier, like, I think too many people in media and journalism in particular are just not particularly thinking about their output as a product and that's something people might want to actually use. They just, you know, think that what they do is inherently good, and if, you know, and look down on anyone that wouldn't want to interact with it, which is, you know, basically arrogant, I suppose. So, you know, that's my role, is to sit between the content team and the product team and get them to work together well and push things new forward. Ultimately, you know, like any experimental thing, you know, roughly half of our new projects won't really move the needle in the way that we wanted them to, so we will stop doing them. But if something, you know, does take off and does do really well and users like it, then ultimately it kind of moves from me spearheading it to one of the other teams within the company will take it on, and it kind of becomes embedded into the day-to-day process. And then for me, it's like, okay, cool, that works, what's the next thing? So I'm always like, you know, month by month, quarter by quarter, trying to push things to the future.
And how important is the side hustle? And do tell us about it. How important is the side hustle in keeping you, you know, really on top of things and go, right, we need to be doing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think it gives me interesting perspective of, you know, how, and I get, so I have this side hustle. It's called Sipping Liquor. It has a lot of overlap with Finimize in a way, that it sells alcohol, not, you know, financial news and education. So, you know, Sipping Liquor helps subscribers improve their liquor cabinets. You know, we deliver a bottle of premium spirits to subscribers' doors, and you have a little magazine that explains what the hell this thing is. You know, is it whiskey? Is it a rum? Is it a, you know, brandy? What is it? Who made it? Because the story behind it is always interesting. And then, like, why is it special? Why have we chosen that? So there's actually really interesting parallels between, you know, running Sipping Liquor as a side gig, direct-to-consumer subscription business that's, you know, very small, versus Finimize, which is, you know, a much bigger company, 25 employees, but ultimately is a direct-consumer business. And I think the parallels are really about they're both you know, alcohol, particularly premium alcohol, and finance, investment. They're both industries that are incredibly opaque, and they rely on jargon. And again, you know, they basically say, you know, this is really complicated. You don't need to know about it. Like, don't worry. And they'll have, you know, if you go on to an investment provider's site, they'll use, you know, terms like yield that just don't mean anything to the normal person. And if you go on, you know, if you pick up the average bottle of whiskey, they'll say things like non-chill filtered, which, you know, doesn't really mean anything until you understand what it does mean. And then you're like, oh, that's not that big a deal really. So, you know, that's the kind of parallels that I find. And I think it is incredibly helpful. I mentioned earlier that Bloomberg was a fantastic place to work, and it is in so many ways, but Bloomberg has a very, very strong corporate culture. And one of the less good points about Bloomberg's corporate culture is that you do not have side hustles. You do not do things outside of Bloomberg. Like, you find you can have hobbies, you have family life, whatever, but like, you know, you wouldn't just go and set up your own business on the side. They would find that very odd. And that, I think, is increasingly looking like a dated mindset.
So, Andrew, we can't let any guests leave without asking them our favourite question, which is, what is your favourite TV ad and why? And if you can, for our audio listeners, do your best to describe it.
I've gone with one from my childhood, just because whenever I think of TV ad, this is just top of mind. And it is the ad for Milk from the late 1980s, featuring these two lads from Liverpool saying, Ian Rush says, if I don't drink lots of milk, I'll only be good enough to play for Accrington Stanley. And the other lad replies, Accrington Stanley, who are they? I guess I have been a lifelong milk drinker, so on some level, maybe it worked. I don't know. Maybe I would have drunk milk anyway. I guess it's impossible to quantify. But yes, I'm not a vegan. I still drink milk. despite being a millennial, just about.
Got any lemonade? If you want. Milk! Ugh! It's what Ian Rush drinks. Ian Rush? Yeah, and he said if I didn't drink lots of milk when I grow up, I'm going to be good enough to play for Accrington Stanley. Accrington Stanley? Who are they? Exactly. Now get off. Give me some. Get off.
Brilliant. Okay, well, Andrew, thank you so much. Good chat. Lovely to hear more about you and Finimize. So thanks for your time and take care.